Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2, most Tuesdays at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Chris Busby, scientist, has got some interesting insight into Novichok, this supposed nerve agent which was used in Salisbury. And he's a chemist. Then, nearly 6 million Irish who died during the famine, only apparently it wasn't a famine. This is a myth. It was deliberate murder because the food was there. It was just taken away under armed guard. Chris Fogarty's on a website called The Irish Holocaust. He's from Chicago. And Sean Day, he's a London cabbie, and he talks about the war that London cabbies are having with Uber. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Dr. Christopher Busby. I was visiting professor at the University of Ulster. I've been engaged in research into the health effects of ionising radiation, but also in the last maybe 15 years, also non-ionising radiation, which is sort of cell phone radiation, and the radiation from power lines. And I've worked as an expert witness in non-ionising radiation power line cases in three areas, and in South Africa and in Long Island and so on. So I know a bit about non-ionising radiation. In fact, I've done research into radio frequency effects. All electromagnetic radiation carries energy, and its energy is proportional to its frequency and inversely proportional to the wavelength. So, ionizing radiation is radiation which is capable of breaking chemical bonds, and that starts around about ultraviolet, and then it goes and into higher frequencies, which involve X-rays and gamma radiation. But at the other end of the visible spectrum, you have infrared, and then beyond that, you have radio frequency. You have long wavelengths, which have traditionally been considered to not have an ability to break chemical bonds. And so, the authorities say that this radiation is safe. And at the high frequency end of that, you have what's called radio frequency, also called microwave radiation, which you get in microwave cookers, and you also are produced by cell phones and various other devices that they're increasingly using, like laptop computers and Wi-Fi, and these new smart meters that are used for connecting everybody together to a sort of super grid.
Oh, that's right. This is called the Internet of Things, isn't it? Can you just give us an idea of how much real safety checking beforehand has been done before these various devices, whether they be laptops, whether they be tablets or mobile phones, have been introduced?
Yes. Well, I mean, as long ago as the 90s, eighties, in fact, research was being carried out into the health effects of radar. Now, radar is operates at a similar frequency to these devices, and the early clunky mobile phones, the ones that you can see on old films, where people have a great sort of brick-like object which they talk to each other on. These produce this radio frequency, and as long ago as the 1980s, it was discovered that these cause health effects. But I mean, originally the effects were just considered to be effects on thinking and sleeplessness and headaches and that kind of thing. But then it became obvious that they were somehow, and nobody knows what the mechanism is, and still don't know what the mechanism is, causing cancer and causing genetic damage. They seem to have some effect on the DNA, and it's the DNA which is at the base of the production of genetic damage, which is cancer. And in the last 20 years, there's overwhelming evidence that these exposures cause a whole range of cancers, particularly brain tumors or tumors on the side of the head where the mobile phone is used. So this is very dangerous. And I mean, even the World Health Organization, which is an extremely conservative organization, outfit, has now accepted that these exposures are possibly carcinogenic, and they've made that quite clear. So they're very dangerous, is the answer.
I mean, I'm just looking at some of the campaign contributions made by the wireless industry and the mobile phone companies. $26 million in the US in contributions in 2016, and something like $87 million in 2017. So there's obviously quite a strong lobby, which is like waving dollar notes and pound notes under politicians' noses to try and make sure that nothing's done about this.
Well, of course, the amount of money that's riding on this is absolutely astronomical. I mean, it's even greater probably than the nuclear industry money that rides on it to try and head off any argument that ionizing radiation causes health effects. The health effects of mobile phone radiation and radio frequency radiation are now unequivocal. I mean, there's no argument about it. But there's an enormous financial effort aimed at trying to show that there is no problem because of the enormous amounts of money involved.
The main bottom line here is, given that many of us feel we have to use these devices, are there any ways that we can actually make sure that we're exposing ourselves and our loved ones, children, etc., as little as possible to the harmful effects of microwaves?
Absolutely. What you have to do is ensure that when you talk to somebody on a mobile phone, and in fact that's why I'm talking to you now, is that you put it on speakerphone and you hold it away from your head, because the energy absorption is proportional to the inverse of the distance from the antenna. So if you hold it away from your head, even like 3 or 4 inches, it's enormously better than holding it to your ear. And and since these things operate all the time, you should not keep them in your pocket. You should keep them in your handbag or at some place, you know, slightly remote from the body. Particularly, you shouldn't keep it in your trouser pockets, because they can cause effects on the DNA. I mean, there was a very interesting study in California where women with breast cancer were shown to have a much higher risk if they popped their mobile phone down between their breasts, you know, which is quite a common way of carrying it, and they would just slide it down in the cleft between in their cleavage, and then of course they got breast cancer. And the other studies have shown that people who are left-handed get brain tumors on the left-hand side of their head, and right-handed get brain tumors on the right side of your head. So this is an extremely serious issue. Particularly for children, because children have cells which replicate rapidly and are much more sensitive to this sort of radiation. So children shouldn't be allowed to have mobile phones. But if they do have them, then their parents should tell them to hold them away from their head, keep them away from their body, and the same with laptops.
Amazing. Is there any signs that any of our authorities, whether it be Brussels in the US, the World Health Organization, or here in the UK, are actually beginning to take this health threat seriously?
Well, there has been advice made by the Medical Officer of Health in England that children shouldn't use mobile phones under the age of 12. So there's a sort of slight, it's sort of creeping into the consciousness of society that there is a problem. I mean, the thing is, it's kind of the same as with asbestos and with cigarette smoking. The people who produce these devices are going to fight this to the limit to try and extend the amount of time that they can sell these things to people and allow them to be used. I set up a study with Ulla Johansson at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm about 4 years ago. We applied for money to study the effects of radiation, of this sort of radiation, and he immediately lost all his funding and they took his lab away. So, I mean, you can see the amount of... of course, you have Sony Ericsson in Sweden, you see, so you can see the amount of pressure that there is there, that they can shut down any research where you try to see if there's an effect.
Well, that is worrying. Also, I wonder if there are any other developments that there have been. I know you're actually quite active doing court cases about various types of radiation. What are your thoughts about what's going on with Hinkley C? Because we keep hearing here in Bristol varying stories about whether it's actually really going to happen or not.
I have been involved recently in the issue of the mud dumping. They're going, in order to bring the channel close up to where the Hinkley site is to bring in these huge reactor vessels from France. And they're going to dump, they decided to dump this mud, radioactive mud, on the Welsh side, about 2 miles from Cardiff, well, 2 kilometres from Cardiff. And so I've been involved in trying to stop that. The answer to your question is I don't think that they will eventually build this. I think the amount of money involved is too much. And the amount of opposition is too great. And so it's just going to sort of drag on endlessly. But that's just my opinion. It could be that they will go ahead with this. But the amounts of money are astronomical, and the blockages that there are all along the line are pretty great.
I noticed that EDF Energy, who are one of the main people involved, have had some serious problems in France with having their active nuclear reactors, power stations, closed down. So they're having to really to sort of forget about Hinkley and just get their existing stations back running again.
Well, all of these big nuclear combines are basically bust. They don't have the money to continue with this ridiculous operation of building nuclear power stations. I mean, this is like steam engines in the age of electricity. I think that they will. Basically, the only reason I think they keep going is because the countries that support them need to have the radionuclides and the reactors for creating the material for nuclear weapons. That's about it. I mean, rationally, it doesn't make sense. There are lots and lots of ways of making electricity which are much cheaper and more efficient and safer.
That was Chris Busby, scientist and green campaigner. His website is greenaudit.org. That's greenaudit.org.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Chris Bogarty. I was born in Chicago of Irish immigrant parents. I returned to Ireland after the Second World War, 1946, and bought a little farm in County Roscommon where I lived there for the next 8 years. My father eventually lived it out the rest of his life and died there. To say that when he died in the year 2000, my father could truthfully say his father was born 161 years ago. That was before. That was quite a long. His father was 65 when he was born, and my father lived to be 97 years. So I came to the States, was a house builder, became a civil engineer, worked throughout Central and South America, and also Borneo. Was drafted into the U.S. Army, served in the occupation army of France. My wife and I have done a great deal of anti-war effort. We've been very, very busy and have run into quite a bit of difficulty, partly because of this attempt that I first made of these mass graves of Ireland and got maybe 900,000 copies out there.
Now, look, I mean, most people have heard about the famines around the mid 19th century, 1845, 1850. But what you're saying is that actually there are mass graves. Is that true?
Yes, Ireland is dotted with mass graves. They're typically about a mile and a half apart. But my book has a map that shows the locations of 180 of the larger mass graves. They're typically a few thousand in each of the 180 mass graves that I point out.
Now, your book, I mean, you talk about the Irish Holocaust. What's the title of your book?
The title of the book is Ireland 1845-1850, The Perfect Holocaust, and Who Kept It, quote, Perfect, unquote.
Okay. This is a very strong word to use, Holocaust, because people will say, "Well, you're comparing it with the Nazi Holocaust." How many people died?
About 5.2 million. The author of the chapter 6 of the book is a man in England who has done quite a bit of census work, and he says that more likely something close to 6 million who were murdered in those years.
Now, you say murdered. You say murdered, yes. But what we hear is that actually it was the failure of the potato crop due to blight.
That's what we all believe. That's what I believed until I was middle age. That's what we were all taught in school on both sides of the Atlantic. That's what we were taught, potato famine. But while doing my grandfather's biography, I found that the regiment that he joined, the 40th of Foot, the Duke of Somerset, had removed the food from South County Galway during the so-called famine. That shocked me because I had always believed it was what we were told, that it was a famine. So I researched further, and I found that more than half the British Army had been deployed into Ireland in those years, and their only task, their only function in Ireland, was removing the abundant food crops from Ireland.
So why was that? Why were they doing that?
That's something I do not know. All I know are the basic facts, which regiment entered what area and what date they departed. Well, first of all, the date they arrived into Ireland and the date they departed Ireland and the date they moved around while in Ireland. All of that is in my book. And also, the volume of food that they removed to the ports for export and the escort ships that escorted the ships to wherever they went. And the Coast Guard that guarded the coast of Ireland from anyone who would interfere with the food removal. And the what else?
So the soldiers were actually there to protect the food. In other words, that there was a possibility that Irish people might try and steal that food.
Yes, there was no army of English harvesters working in Ireland. All those crops were created by, sown by, weeded and grown by the Irish and harvested by the Irish. But at that time, Ireland was run by English landlords in Ireland. All of the land, according to Encyclopedia Britannica, 97% of the land of Ireland's land was owned by English landlords. They were all moved out. They were all bought out by the British government. And their land was distributed to the Irish people. The land of Ireland now is among Europe's best distributed. But until 1900 to 1920, in those years are the years in which the English landlords were moved out of Ireland and back to England. While they were there, the genocide continued. The eviction, the destruction of the Irish continued as long as those landlords were in Ireland.
Around about the same time, you've got a lot of Irish migration to North America, haven't you? I imagine that's not a coincidence.
Yes. The immigration to North America has been going on for a very long time before that, before and after the U.S. Revolution of 1776. A lot of food was sent over, and a huge amount of money was sent over to pay the rent to the families of the Irish, to their English landlords at the time. The rent payment for the use of land in Ireland was typically more than what could be earned off the land. And it's a shocking piece of work. By the way, it's also important to say that a certain percentage, a large minority percentage, of those British regiments in Ireland were Irish soldiers. So there are bloody heads also to be shared among the Irish. My own grandfather helped the British to do to the Maoris in New Zealand and the Aborigines in Australia and to the Indians and the Indian subcontinent, the Bangladeshis and others, what had been done to his own parents in Ireland. Lord Ashbrooke of Castle Durrow in Durrow County Leash, Lord Ashbrooke, he evicted my great-grandparents and my granduncles and grandaunt in 1836, before my grandfather was born. My grandfather was born in the shadow of Lord Ashbrooke's gallows on Gallows Hill, uphill of the gates to the castle of Castle Durrow County Beach. That was the seventh Lord Ashbrook at the time, the fifth, sixth, and seventh at the time. The current Lord Ashbrook, the 11th, is living in Arley Hall, Cheshire, England, today. So they keep going. I don't know how he's earning his money, but he has a multi-thousand acre estate yet in Cheshire, the current Lord Ashbrook.
I mean, what you're describing, the nearly 6 million Irish that died in this, what isn't really, you're describing not as a famine, but as a deliberate starvation. What was the purpose?
Yes.
I'm going to ask you again, what was the purpose of starving all these people?
Well, I don't know the purpose, but one spokesman for the British government said, with a certain degree of satisfaction, obviously, the way it's written, that the kelp will soon be as scarce on the banks of the Shannon River, as the red man is on the bank of the Manhattan.
Okay, so they're talking about really comparing the Irish people to the Red Indians and the Native Americans.
Yes, it was intended to be a complete wipeout, evidently.
What about the Irish government? What have they been doing about this history? Because have they acknowledged the truth of the mass graves, for example?
It's shocking. I wish, in a certain sense, that I had died before I learned this. It puts one into a permanent grief. It's a little bit like the concern so many of us have for the Palestinians. It's a constant sense of grief, of mourning. And maybe particularly because the people, when they were murdered, they were first murdered, and then they were slandered in death for the next 170 years. That's unbearable to me. That's why when my wife and I put up a memorial over one of those mass graves, we feel a tremendous relief.
What about the Irish government? What are they doing?
The Irish government are the main opponents to what we're doing. They slur us. They slander us also now. They would like to imprison us. They would like to get us into trouble. The RTE, Radio Television, the state monopoly of broadcasting in Ireland, I was interviewed by the most popular, it's my understanding, the most popular radio announcer in Ireland, Joe Duffy, on Radio 1 of RTE Ireland. And he accused me of putting a memorial up over a mass grave. He set me up for ridicule and questioned whether I had the right to do it, even though the local people were the ones who were asking me, but they're too afraid to do so. The people in RD outside, he was referring to one mass grave headstone in particular in Smarmore, RD, County Louth. And the people of RD had been going there on pilgrimages for the last 170 years, most of them Catholics, I suppose, because they would go there to say prayers for the souls of those who were murdered and buried there. And in a mass grave that no one ever marked as a mass grave, though it takes up the northern half of the cemetery. The entire northern half is taken up by people who were buried in cartloads from the workhouse in RD, County Louth.
So how did these people die? I mean, did these people just simply die of famine, or were some of them deliberately killed?
Very, very few were murdered in the sense of being shot through the heart or bayoneted or something. There was some of them, but very little. They were mostly all died of starvation or of the diseases attendant upon malnutrition. When the food was removed, they soon became hungry and everything then went bad.
Okay, and over the space of 5 years or so, how many people are buried in the typical mass grave? And were the mass graves open for several years or for periods of time?
They're there. They're generally overgrown, typically with no marker of any kind. Some do. Some have markers, but the markers tend to be, they say, typically famine graves. Famine graves. And of the six memorials that my wife and I have put up, only one of them had ever any kind of a mark on it. a marker on it of the people there. And yet everyone knows where these mass graves are. They still whisper about them. But they don't tell their children much. It all comes by, it's very, very sotto voce. They keep their, it's very sub rosa. They don't mention it much. And yet we all learn about it in time. But the mass graves are there. The local people all know where their own mass grave is. And the Irish government is absolutely opposed to anyone learning about them.
Why is that?
I find it hard to believe. I do not understand. Ireland must be the only nation on earth, the only one I've ever heard of, that conceals a genocide of their own people. I don't get it. I do not understand it.
I mean, is it because this is a bit of history which is too difficult to deal with?
No, I'm afraid it's more vicious than that. I'm afraid that they are either being blackmailed or bribed into acquiescence.
How many graves are there again? Where are they? And how many people buried?
My map shows the location, the precise locations of 180 of them. They're scattered throughout the country. But they're, according to, of the six mass graves that my wife and I put up, only one of those mass graves shows on my map. They were brought to my attention later. So I'm thinking that there are probably about 3,000 mass graves in what can be called mass graves in Ireland.
And so what source material have you used to get your facts?
Mostly coming from people the first one came to me to ask me if a certain pamphlet was mine. And I said, yes. Well, he said, there's something I want to show you. This is in Ballymoe, County Galway. So I visited him the next day, and he showed me a mass grave that his father and gang had found in 1910 when they were putting up fences to divide the land from the old English landlord to the Irish recipient. And he brought me to the mass grave. It was he didn't have the exact spot. Finally, the exact spot was determined by the owner of the land, who never plowed that land after the first year there when it was given back to the Irish, and he hit bodies. He hit a mass of bodies, plowing the land nearest to his bog. He never plowed. There were so many bodies that he stopped to plow, never plowed that field again. That's one mass grave, and we put up a memorial over it. Well, first of all, we put it up over where the entire village had been wiped out, where the village once stood. And then the following year, we learned the precise location from the children of the owner who had to stop plowing because the mass grave was at a specific location in a certain field. That field was left unplowed ever since, and has never been plowed to this day.
So has there ever been a map? Has there ever been a map made of where these mass graves were, and have you discovered any maps that were made at the time?
No, there are no maps. They were buried, and the people who buried them, many were hoped that the people would never remember. They were all Catholic Irish, but they were typically buried outside consecrated ground, outside the wall of the local cemetery. They were not considered to have a future life. There was no eternal life for them. They had no souls, according to their own people in control of the situation. They were not given Christian burials. They were buried in dumps. They were dumped in pits outside the consecrated ground, outside the wall of the so-called holy ground.
Okay, and how many of these mass graves have you been able to confirm exist?
You mean how many have we been able to monument?
How many have you managed to confirm that there is a mass grave there?
Well, 180 on the map, and another 187, and then in my book, as people come to me and point out the areas, they typically have the name like Pauper's Ground. They all know what they are. They call them famine graves. So I might have another 30 in my book that I've added that are not on the map. So maybe 210.
Tell us about your book and where people can find out more about this.
Again, the title of the book is Irish Ireland, 1845-1850, The Perfect Holocaust, and Who Kept It, quote, Perfect, unquote. It's available in Ireland from a John Robinson. I can give you his telephone number. I'll have to dig it up. Or he could be emailed. Maybe better yet, he can be emailed at 1 second now. And let's see. I'm determined, because all of the so-called famine writers all work for profit, I am determined that I will make no profit from this book. My wife and I have been putting up mass grave memorials since before I even thought of doing a book. I thought my pamphlets would silence the liars, but it didn't. So then I went to, when the internet came out, I put it on the internet. And I thought the internet would silence them. It did force the famine writers to abandon about 90% of their lies, but they've had to adopt a new lie to accommodate the tremendous volume of food that was being shipped out of Ireland at the time. That can no longer be denied.
I mean, give us an idea of how much food was being shipped out at the time.
Well, I'll go to my book and just take a second to dig it out. 1 second, please. I also have which regiment was where at which time. 1 second now.
I just want the quantity of food, because that gives people an idea of how much food was leaving the country.
Yes. What I've used for that is the British papers are full of it at the time. You see, there's no need to dwell on it too much. Here's one sample. On July 28, 1848, when perhaps half of the Holocaust victims had already expired, the Limerick Intelligencer, a reporter of shipping news, recorded a typical day's food shipments from only the following four ports. From Limerick, the Anne, John Guy's, and Messenger for London, the Pelton Clinton for Liverpool, and the City of Limerick, British Queen, and Cambrian Maid for Glasgow. This one day removal of Limerick food was of 863 firkins of butter, 212 firkins, 1,198 casks, and 200 kegs of lard, 87 casks of ham, 267 bales of bacon, 52 barrels of pork, 45 tons and 628 barrels of flour, 4,975 barrels of oats, and 1,000 of pork, 45 tons and 628 barrels of flour, 4,975 barrels of oats, and 1,000 barrels of barley. From Kilrush, that's in County Clare, the Ellen for Bristol, the Charles G. Fryer, and Mary Elliott for London. This one-day removal was of 550 tons of County Clare oats and 15 tons of its barley. From Tralee, that's in County Kerry, the John St. Barb, Claudia, and Queen for London, the spokesman for Liverpool. This one-day removal was of 711 tons of Kerry oats and 118 tons of its barley. From Galway, the Mary, Victoria, and Diligence for London, the Swan and Union for Limerick for transshipment to England. This one-day removal was of 60 sacks of County Galway flour, 30 sacks and 292 tons of its oatmeal, 294 tons of its oats, and 140 tons of its miscellaneous provisions, edibles. British soldiers forcibly removed it from its starving Limerick, Clare, Kerry, and Galway producers.
Okay, what year was that?
That was on July 28, 1848.
Amazing. That's really the height. That's the height of the famine, really.
It's actually a little bit beyond, a little bit toward the tapering down end. 1847 was the nearly half the people died in 1 year, 1847.
And is there any reliable estimate of the number of people that died altogether?
About 5.2 million. But here's from the time, the people might not want to believe the Limerick Intelligencer, the Times of London, November 5th, 1846. Irish produce. The importation of provisions from the Irish ports into the port of Liverpool during the week from the 6th to the 22nd, ultimo, inclusively, comprised the following list of articles. These: 14,106 firkins, 285 half-firkins, 1,512 baskets and casks, 258 boxes of butter, 8,655 barrels, 571 sacks, and 225 quarters of wheat, 1,960 sacks of flour, 61 tons weight, and 700 quarters, a quarter is a quarter ton, of oats, 922 sacks, and 735 other packages of oatmeal. It goes down and on.
Can you give us an idea of what your experience was actually in Ireland putting a memorial on these mass graves?
Yes. The local people are very relieved. They have been coming to me to see if I could do something that they are afraid to do. Once we put up the first one, that's four other people came to us. In fact, they were in attendance at that consecration inauguration outside Ballymore, County Galway, when we put up the first one. Again, groups from four other mass grave locations, they begged us to try and do the same thing for their mass grave. And it took me until last year to get one of them done. And two of them were completely blocked from me. The people became terrorized and they completely gave up any further drive to do it. They have been intimidated by their, quote, betters, unquote. There's a pecking order in Ireland that's really pathetic. And the people have learned that they had better obey the local norms, and the local norms are set by the Anglo-Irish.
Okay, I don't think that's just in Ireland that pecking order exists. Anyway, look, if people are interested in following this and maybe supporting your work, how can they get in touch, Chris?
How can they get in touch with us? Well, they can. Quite a few hundreds, maybe 2,000 people now or more, have copies of the book. They're contacting me, and they're lending the book to others. And so that's one way of doing it. I had a website up for IrishHolocaust.org since over 20 years, I think. It was just taken down last week. It just disappeared. I don't know why. It's just one of those mysteries I don't understand. It was up and was doing fine work, and I thought it didn't complete the job of silencing the famine writing industry. And that's why I wrote the book, and I'm hoping that the book will do what the pamphlet and the website did not quite accomplish, didn't quite manage it. But
so can you just tell us where we can get copies of the book? You were looking up some details, phone number and email.
Here's the email address, John Robinson, all one word, at EIRCOM, that's EIRCOM.com. John Robinson at earcom.com, and he'll send you whoever's interested in the book. I donated all the books printed in Ireland. I donated to a group who are doing some pretty good work. They're trying to get the Irish people to understand that there was a free Irish government that was set up after the 1918 elections by the elected officials, and they founded Dáil Éireann on January 21, 1919, after the 1918 elections. But King George V declared it an illegal assembly and set about imprisoning and shooting the elected members of the government. And then on December 6, 1921, the British government imposed its own government on Ireland. And all subsequent governments of Ireland had been successors to the one that was imposed by Churchill and King George V. So it's sort of a sad story. That explains a lot. There's an awful lot about Ireland that I found hard to understand. when living here in Chicago, where I am, I was up from South America, and I asked our Irish Consul General, shouldn't we be doing something about the Birmingham Six, that they had been tortured into confessing to a bombing in Birmingham, and they were obviously innocent, and that should we be doing something for them? He said, oh, no, terrorism, terrorism, oh, no, terrorism. So we didn't do anything, and then nearly 10 years later, we got interested again. We would no longer pay any attention to him, and he played a small role in freeing them. By locking up those Birmingham Six, the British government kept the actual killers, the actual bombers, at large. You wonder why they would do that. But that's what happened to them and the Guildford Four. The movie, there was a film made of the Guildford Four in the name of the father, same kind of thing. But there's a simpler one that has not been exposed at all yet, and that is the August 15th, 1998 bombing by MI5 and the Chicago FBI agent, along with a lifelong criminal, who moved from Chicago to Ireland in 1994 and remained there until mission accomplished for MI5. And that was the bombing murder of 29 people in Omagh, County Tyrone. It was an IRA bomb, but it was the bomb car was owned by an Irish government agent, and they were all working with the Chicago FBI and MI5, and they managed to turn that IRA bomb into an atrocity. There had been five previous IRA bombs in which nobody at all got hurt, but there was property damage done, for which the British government, the Exchequer, was paying. So with the help of MI5 and the Chicago FBI, they managed to turn that into an atrocity, and that defeated the IRA. The British Army did not defeat the IRA, but MI5 and the Chicago FBI did. They defeated the FBI. The Good Friday Agreement was driven home, which surrendered the six disputed counties to the British government. It is now an undisputed British province, and that's ended that. So the pretty much the same conditions continue in the six counties for the native Irish kind of difficult living there.
Interesting take on the Good Friday Agreement. Anyway, okay, Chris, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name's Sean Forday. I'm a London cab driver. I also do London taxi radio, but first and foremost, I'm a London cabbie.
Can you tell us what the advantages are of a London cabbie, because some people will say, well, actually, it's one of the more expensive types of taxis that you can get in London. There's lots of apps around nowadays, like the Uber app, which are a lot cheaper.
That's right. I think the perception is that they're a lot cheaper, when in fact they can be more expensive because of the surge pricing aspect of them. What you do have with a black cab is a regulated meter, so you will always know what price you're paying. And that will never exceed that, no matter how busy it is out there on the road. I think the advantages that come with a purpose-built vehicle, along with a driver who actually knows where he is going, you can pretty much gain efficiency from that, knowing that you will end up in the place that you need to be. And not only that, I think it caters for the wheelchair disabled, the hearing impaired and the sight impaired. It is a really, truly purpose-built vehicle. And it kind of covers a broad spectrum for those people that might be more vulnerable in society, whereas Uber doesn't cover that at all.
Now, we're in the situation now, aren't we, where there's been a challenge to Uber's license to operate in London. What's happened with that story?
Well, I mean, because they've been here for quite a while, we're forgiven for thinking that they are legal. They are not. They are illegal. They're in contravention of the 1998 Private Hire Act, which means they shouldn't be here at all. But they've been allowed to come here, run roughshod through our democratic process, and carry on operating. Now, the consequences of that and the consequences of their drivers working on demand, so instant hire, means there's been a catastrophic fallout, really. And you've had something like 48 sexual assaults in 1 year alone, and that's a 50% increase on the year before. You've got, you in London, you've had a terrorist attack, which was an Uber driver, and you've also had three murders. And this comes as a consequence of working on demand with no accountability.
Can you tell us what you get when you get a black cab? You obviously get someone who's been through the knowledge, which is actually quite a complicated... it's actually an exam, isn't it? That you have to know your way around London and prove that you do. But what are the other advantages?
I think the advantages of getting a purpose-built vehicle, that the real nucleus of this is safety. I mean, in comparison to Uber last year, there was no sexual assault inside a black cab. Now, in any industry, you could have isolated incidents, but there was none in a black cab. So you've got that assurance. But I don't think they have the marketing platform that someone like Uber has that pushes something like $2 billion a year into marketing and lobbying government to affirm their position without actually putting in any provision to protect either the passenger or the driver. But the knowledge is forgotten about, and I think not only does it help the passenger get to where they need to be because the driver actually knows where they're going, it is also a stringent vetting process covering about 3 years. It's a stringent licensing process, and the knock-on effect from that is a safe journey to wherever you've got to go.
But the thing is, many people will see you as a Luddite. This is new technology which actually makes it cheaper to get from A to B.
Well, I'm not sure whether it does make it cheaper, like I said, with the surge pricing. And I think the issue here is we've had apps before Uber came along. Halo was in London before Uber came. And not only do we have the apps that cater for taxis, so you could always, if you want that accountability, you could always get one of the taxi apps. But also, London cab drivers also have their own app in the form of Taxi App. Now, this isn't corporate-owned. I think one of the problems here with pricing, and we talked about pricing and the cost of taxis, is the value of the job itself and the cost index it takes to run that vehicle. Now, Uber is being subsidised. At the moment, Uber is being subsidised by funding from countries with ethical, questionable human rights records, like the Qatari, Saudi Arabia, like Russia's First Bank. They take funding from there to subsidise tests to break incumbent trades. Now, once the black cab trade is gone, not only do you have a vehicle that caters for the wheelchair dependents, or the hearing impaired, or the sight impaired, all those who still want to pay by cash because it's still legal, then you do away with that, and what you're left with is a service that someone who hasn't got credit, someone who hasn't got a smartphone, can't even access. It's a discriminatory service in that sense, and they should be guilty of every discrimination order there is.
Also, you know, we're in a situation now where we've got all sorts of accusations, and in fact court cases where it's proven that some of these Uber drivers have assaulted passengers. What is the situation in London? Is the Uber service up and running, or has it been banned?
They're on appeal at the moment, which means they have been refused. They haven't been revoked a license. They've been refused a license to continue. Now, they are allowed to appeal that decision. And all the while they're appealing, then the drivers will be allowed to continue working on the streets. But under Section 2, subsection 6, they could revoke their licence now and stop the drivers from working here in London.
Okay, so given all these assaults, why hasn't the Mayor of London revoked that licence then?
Well, exactly. Why hasn't the Mayor of London? We call on the Mayor of London to revoke that licence. Since they've been... refused operator's license, you've had an inexorable rise in sexual assault. You've had Uber go for arbitration processes instead of going to the court system to hide the amount of sexual assault there's been. There's been something called greyballing, which is a kind of ring fencing of the authority so they wasn't privileged to certain information. There's been license at the moment.
Okay. What about the black cab? How long can it last if something's not done about this?
Who's got the most staying power? But again, they have come here and they're operating outside the law. And no one should. It doesn't matter if you favour black cabs or not. No one should be in favour of any multinational coming into the country, disregarding the democratic process of that country and carrying on working.
Well, hang on, Sean, because some will say that actually that's what's going on in the City of London too. Some of the big banks operating outside the law.
Well, absolutely, and maybe there should be accountability there also. You've got to look at the close relationship again with some of the political parties with companies like Uber. Uber, you've got BlackRock, the American investment bank. They invest heavily in Uber. And there you go. You've got George Osborne. He leaves government, disgraced leaves government, and goes to work for BlackRock for one day a week for £500,000 a year. There you go. So you've got self-invested interests with politicians that also have investment in insurance that also, they've all got their pension schemes in them. So you think, well, they're very reluctant to put in any regulation against this company.
Absolutely incredible. Now, you do your black cab radio. Have you heard any stories as part of that about the Uber drivers?
There's always a lot of stories. It's a very good time to be on the radio or do a radio show or any media which concerns Uber because it's there's a lot to report, obviously.
Well, just give us a couple of stories.
A couple of stories. I mean, we try not to focus on the Uber drivers so much because we don't find them particularly that interesting. But I mean, if you keep up to date with London Taxi Radio on Twitter, you'll be able to get the Periscope and you'll see the amazing time we had during our demonstration.
Oh, yeah, these demonstrations. I mean, how many black cabs do you get together at one time?
Well, considering what London is like, it doesn't take a lot to kind of bring it to a standstill. I mean, we don't really want to bring it to a standstill, but like I said, the black cab trade, because it's made up of 24,000 sole traders, doesn't really have that platform to be able to get the message out there. And if the message is being buried as well, because if you needed to go to a newspaper, if you needed credible journalists, if you needed someone to really dig down and get to the bottom of this in London, who would you go to? You'd probably go to the Evening Standard. And who's the editor of the Evening Standard? George Osborne. So if you think you're going to get to the bottom of this just by going to the press, you're going to have to wait a very long time.
Tell us also about your Black Cabs app, so that if people are in London, that they can make sure they've got that rather than the Uber app.
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course, there's My Taxi, there's Guest, but the real trade black cab app is simply called Taxi App. That's it. Download Taxi App. If you're in London, you will be guaranteed a black cab, meter fare, no problem at all.
And what about your radio station? Where can we find that online?
LondonTaxiRadio.co.uk, website, Twitter or Facebook page. And you can listen to the live stream on Swisher Radio.
Okay, Sean, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much. Take care.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Or subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Chris Busby at greenaudit.org, to Chris Fogarty, whose website is called The Irish Holocaust, and to Sean Day at londontaxiradio.co.uk, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 most Tuesdays at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.